European Impositions and the Myth of Morohood, Chapter 4. The predominant theme enunciated in the official discourse of Muslim nationalism in the Philippines is that of Morohood, the postulated existence of a single, deeply rooted Philippine Muslim cultural identity. Morohood is said to have developed principally as a result of more than 300 years of religious warfare against Spanish invaders. This chapter examines the modern myth of Morohood in light of the historical evidence from Cotabato concerning the nature of the armed resistance to Spanish aggression in the Muslim Philippines. I begin by investigating the political economy of the pre-colonial Cotabato Basin, tracing how political and economic relations within and between its indigenous polities were shaped and transformed by external perturbations in international trade and European conquest. While a significant number of Southeast Asian sultanates were founded or dramatically expanded as the direct or indirect consequence of the initial European invasion of Southeast Asia at the opening of the 16th century, none have had their histories more thoroughly entangled with that of European penetration of the region than the Cotabato Sultanates. The rise and fall of the Cotabato Sultanates is bracketed by two separate conquests, that of the first Western colonial power in the region and that of the final. Sarip Kabungsuan, the legendary founder of the Cotabato Sultanates, was a refugee from the Portuguese seizure of Melaka in 1511. Datu Ali, the last independent Cotabato ruler, was captured and killed by the American colonizers of the Philippines in 1905. In the intervening centuries, the Cotabato Sultanates were inflected and eventually deranged as the result of encounters with various agents of European expansion. The most frequent and intense engagements, economic and military, were with the Spaniards, who, from the outset of their occupation of the northern Philippines in 1571, sought the political subjugation of, as well as expanded trade with the southern sultanates. A tributary mode of production. The three main indigenous populations of the Cotabato Basin, the Maguindanaon, Iranun, and Tiruray, were linked together from the earliest historic period in a single political economic system based on the external acquisition of plunder and slave labor and the internal production of commodities for external trade. It was a system propelled by the direct extraction of surpluses from primary producers by political or military means, and the circulation of that surplus through the transactions of commercial intermediaries, what has been called a tributary mode of production by Amin and Wolf. That system comprised two principal socio-economic categories that cross-cut ethno-linguistic boundaries: tribute takers and tribute providers. Tribute providers were predominantly direct producers, either freemen or slaves. Tribute takers consisted primarily of local overlords or datus, linked with one another through intermarriage, through patronage arrangements, and by means of the ideology of nobility related in the previous chapter. Chinese sources from the Ming period and earlier suggest that by at least AD 1300, there existed in Cotabato a harbor principality engaged in substantial direct trade with China. Early Spanish accounts of Cotabato from the mid-16th century are the first to report the existence of two rival power centers in the Cotabato Valley. These adjacent sultanates had areas of influence corresponding to the dialect boundaries between Tau Sa Ilud and Tau Sa Laya, with the seat of the Maguindano Sultanate in present-day Cotabato City at the mouth of the Pulangi River, and that of the Buwayan Sultanate upstream near what is now Datupiang. However, at different points in the history of their rivalry, each one was controlled for significant lengths of time by the other. The upriver and downriver sultanates were similarly structured, and they conform to a general socio-political type that has been characterized as a segmentary state or a contest state. They were loose confederations of local overlords or datus. Datus formed a tribute-taking aristocracy with hereditary claims to allegiance from followers. While a ruling datu was almost always associated with a specific district or inged, the index of relative political potency was command of people rather than control of territory. In accord with the pattern that pertained throughout pre-colonial Southeast Asia, where arable land was more abundant and thus less valuable than human resources, the wealth of a ruling datu was secured through rights over persons rather than rights in land. The land under cultivation in a particular domain was held in usufruct by individuals, but the datu had the final right of disposition, according to William Henry Scott, 1982. Datus usually held large tracts of land for their own use that were worked by slave labor. The non-slave followers, mdatuan, of a datu were obliged to provide him support in the form of scheduled payments of a portion of their crops and unscheduled contributions for prestige feasts or bride wealth payments. They were also required to perform military and non-military labor service. Datus used surplus wealth to support themselves and the armed followings that were the basis of their power. Wealth was also used as capital to engage in or finance trading or slave raiding expeditions. Chattel slaves, banyaga, taken in raids or warfare or purchased, were a common form for storing and investing surplus wealth. Banyaga were exchanged as part of bride wealth payments and were also a medium of commercial exchange. Other non-free subjects of datus were debt slaves or ulipun. Endataun, endatuan, could be reduced to ulipun for a number of causes, the rate of reduction often being related to the availability and cost of banyaga at the time. New debt slaves were either added to a datu's personal following or put to work to produce food or provide menial services to the datu's household. Typically, a significant portion of a datu's debt slaves were utilized as personal retinue or armed retainers and were supported by banyaga or other debt slaves. The Maguindanaoan tribute-taking elite recognized the hereditary claim of one among them to allegiance from all other members of the aristocracy. Because of the existence of a royal Barabangsa bloodline, the sultan was not simply a primus inter pares ruler. He was nonetheless a datu who, as a result of the combination of pedigree and political savvy, commanded the allegiance of other datus. That allegiance was accomplished and maintained primarily through the creation of dyadic alliances between the sultan and individual datus, arrangements commonly sealed either by his bestowal of a daughter in marriage or his marriage to a daughter of another datu. Because datus ruling ingeds were the basic components of a sultanate, the authority of a sultan was exerted not over a royal domain as such, but over his datu supporters, linked together in a network of dyadic alliances. A reigning sultan had the formal right to collect taxes and tariffs, render legal decisions, and make various administrative appointments. He did not hold a monopoly on the means of violence, and despite his capability to apply substantive coercive force, military power was widely diffused. In addition to the taxes collected by a sultan, primarily tolls and commercial river traffic, and the tribute he received in various forms from datu supporters, the sultan had his own inged and tribute-providing commoners. A significant portion of a sultan's wealth, however, probably came from his privileged access to sources of wealth external to his realm, derived from wars conducted on his enemies, slave raids on or tribute-collecting visits to non-Muslim neighbors, and his privileged access to trade with external powers. Much of a sultan's wealth was also held in the form of slaves, the number of which was the most important index of prestige and power, according to Ileto. External acquisitions and the flow of tribute. Despite their development as rival power centers, the two principal Cotabato sultanates were linked throughout most of their history in a single economic system based on the commercial production of rice and the collection of forest products and the external exchange of these commodities for prestige goods, firearms, and bullion. The upriver Buayan Sultanate was located in the fertile upper valley of the Pulangi. Rice was one of the primary exports from Cotabato, and it is likely that the major portion of all rice exported from Cotabato was grown in the upper valley. Slave labor was centrally important to the economy of the Buayan Sultanate, and much of it was probably utilized in commercial rice production. In the mid-19th century, Datu Utu, the effective sultan of Buayan and the most powerful man in the Cotabato Valley for much of his rule, was reported to have 4,000 to 5,000 slaves, according to Gayangos, cited in Ileto. Lesser datus usually held fewer than 100 slaves. While debt slaves almost always originated from within the domain of the Sultanate, chattel slaves or banyaga were originally acquired from outside. It is probable because of the proximity of the Buwayan Sultanate to upland areas and its relative distance from the sea coasts that were at the source of slaves seized from the Spanish territories, that most of the banyaga of the Buwayan Sultanate were obtained in raids on non-Muslim upland groups. For most of its history, however, the Buwayan Sultanate did not raid its closest upland neighbors, the Tiruray, for banyaga slaves. Instead, slave hunters went farther afield to raid the Manobo of the Central Cordillera or the Bilaan or Tibuli of the southern Tiruray Highlands. This was because Tiruray communities had been incorporated as client groups in both sultanates. Tiruray communities entered into unequal, ritually reinforced trade relationships with individual Maguindanaoan datus. In exchange for Tiruray products, the datu provided salt, iron, cloth, and other manufactured goods, and just as important, protection from other datus. During his stay in Cotabato, Forrest observed profoundly unequal exchanges between Tirurays and Maguindanaoans. He reported loans forced on Tirurays to create permanent indebtedness and described Tirurays and their own communities being abused and treated like slaves by visiting Maguindanaoans. The incentive for incorporating the Tiruray into the Buwayan Sultanate as clients was the value of the products the Tiruray could provide. In their upland fields, the Tiruray grew tobacco, an important item for external trade, and upland rice valued by the Maguindanaoan for domestic consumption. Equally important was the forest products collected by the Tiruray. The mainstays of the forest product trade were beeswax, rattan, and hardwoods. The Tiruray were thus critically important to datus as collectors, or in the case of tobacco, producers of products that could be traded externally at great profit for highly valued Chinese goods. Consequently, they were not enslaved but instead incorporated into the economic system as clients to perform this specialized role. Tiruray communities were compelled to collect forest products to meet the trade and tribute demands of the Maguindanaoan datus, as well as to satisfy their own consumption needs. The terms of exchange probably shifted according to changes in the external market and were constrained, on the one hand, by datus needing to avoid exploitation so extreme as to drive Tiruray communities beyond their effective reach, and on the other, by the awareness on the part of those communities of their need for externally derived goods and the long-range capabilities of Maguindanaoan slave raiders. Relations between the upriver and downriver sultanates were also centered on internal and external trade. The upriver Maguindanaoan were in need of the very same salt, metals, and cloth that they provided to the Tiruray. They obtained these, as well as prestige goods and bullion, in trade with the downriver sultanate. In exchange, they provided rice, tobacco, forest products, and occasionally upland banyaga slaves for domestic markets and further trading. Although external trade was sometimes carried on directly, it was more commonly channeled through the downriver sultanate. Despite periods of political tension and warfare, trade relations were always maintained, even when the downriver sultanate was occupied by the Spanish. After 1755, the river trade between the sultanates was increasingly facilitated by Chinese traders. While the upriver and downriver sultanates were similarly structured, the Maguindanao Sultanate, because of its location at the river mouth, exhibited certain important differences. The Sultan of Maguindanao probably had no more success than his upriver counterpart at collecting all the taxes and tribute due to him from his client datus, especially those from outlying ingeds. However, he did possess a greater number of alternative sources of revenue than did the Buwayan Sultan. In addition to collecting river tolls on vessels engaged in internal trade, the Sultan of Maguindanao levied customs duty on arriving merchant ships and collected anchorage fees from warships. The capital of the Maguindanao Sultanate was wealthier and more cosmopolitan than that of the interior sultanate. William Dampier described the capital, located then in Simuay, just across the Pulangi River and downstream from present-day Cotabato City in 1686, as the chiefest city on the island of Mindanao, and reported that Malay, the trade language of insular Southeast Asia, was spoken widely and well there. A key element in the maritime orientation of the Maguindanao Sultanate was its relationship with the Iranun populations that resided within its territory. European accounts beginning in the mid-18th century identify the Iranun as specialized maritime raiders who channeled large amounts of externally acquired wealth in the form of slaves, plunder, and occasionally external tribute back into the Sultanate. Swift Iranun warships set out south from Ilana Bay to harry coastal villages, merchant vessels, and Dutch settlements in Sulawesi, the Celebes, and Maluku, the Moluccas. Larger Iranun raids were directed against Spanish territories in the Philippines. The coastal towns of southern Luzon and the Visayas were the victims of persistent, large-scale attacks from Moro sea raiders. Captives were sold externally, usually to Bugis or Brunei slave traders, or internally along the Pulangi River. Spaniards or other prominent captives were usually allowed to redeem themselves by ransom immediately after their seizure. The Iranun occupied an important niche in the socio-economic system of the pre-colonial Cotabato Basin. They formed autonomous coastal communities headed by Datus or petty sultans. Although living in close proximity to the Maguindanao Sultanate and often aligned with it, the Iranun were never incorporated into the Sultanate as subjects, and they assiduously guarded their political independence. When allied with the downriver sultan, the Iranun provided him with very significant economic and political support. The internal circulation of the wealth seized externally by Iranun raiders was also a vital component of the economic prosperity of the Maguindanao Sultanate. One non-indigenous population played a significant role in the commercial life of the pre-colonial Cotabato Basin. The Chinese have lived continuously in Cotabato longer than any other non-Muslim immigrant group. Chinese permanent residence in the Maguindanao Sultanate almost certainly predates the Spanish occupation of the northern Philippines. Dampier found an established Chinese community in Cotabato in 1686, some of whose members worked as accountants for the Sultan. In 1755, the expulsion of most of the Chinese in the Spanish-held Philippines was carried out by colonial authorities. Some of those expelled settled in the Maguindanao Sultanate. That resettlement would account in part for the larger and more visible Chinese community described by Forrest in 1775. He reports Chinese in Cotabato working as carpenters and herbalists and operating commercial rice mills and palm wine distilleries. They were also apparently well engaged in the inter-sultanate trade in local products for Chinese goods. According to Forrest, the Chinese settled the Maguindanao Sultanate were not permitted to trade farther river than Buayan, the upriver capital, because the Maguindanaoans were jealous of their superior abilities in trade. Despite their commercial success, the social and legal status of the Chinese in the Cotabato was precarious and certainly no better than that of the Chinese of Manila. While the Chinese possessed skills and provided economic benefits to the Maguindanao Sultanate comparable to those of the Iranun, their lack of political and military power tended to relegate them to the status of the Tirurai or other upland client groups. Pre-colonial Cotabato and the European mercantile expansion. In his watershed work, Europe and the People Without History, Eric Wolff cautions that the operation of a tributary mode of production in any particular state is at least in part determined by whether the state is weak or strong in relation to other polities. Successful surplus extraction cannot be understood in terms of an isolated society alone. Rather, it is a function of the changing organization of the wider field of power within which the particular tributary constellation is located. Unquote. The proposition that power relations between societies have a determining influence on local political economic orders is nowhere more clearly illustrated than in the Cotabato Sultanates. Within decades of their establishment, which occurred most probably in the first half of the 16th century, the Cotabato Sultanates began to feel the severe effects of the intrusion of European powers into the region. The most intense collisions were with the Spaniards, who occupied the northern Philippines in 1571 and almost immediately sought to subdue the Muslim South. The first three Spanish military expeditions against Cotabato were failures. On the third in 1596, the commander of the expedition was slain and the Spaniards forced eventually to abandon the fort that had been their foothold in Cotabato. Before doing so, the acting commander reportedly cut down or set fire to all the coconut and sago palms within reach of his patrols to the number of 50,000 trees, according to Horacio de la Costa, 1961. A tactic foreshadowing the economic strangulation to be applied to Cotabato in place of direct armed assault. The Spaniards withdrew to Zamboanga, where they established a garrison at the tip of the Zamboanga Peninsula in order to control the sea lanes leading to and from Cotabato. The Spanish fort commanded the channel between the peninsula and the island of Basilan, the normal route of sea travel between Cotabato and the rest of the archipelago. Patrol boats based at the fort rerouted Chinese junks coming from the north bound for Cotabato. When manned, the fort was quite effective in impeding the direct China-Cotabato trade. It was much less successful at curtailing maritime raiding. Iran and marauders easily eluded Spanish patrol boats in the Basilan Straits to raid throughout insular Southeast Asia, with the Spanish Philippines becoming their preferred destination. By the mid-18th century, Spanish colonial authorities had largely disarmed the Philippine population subject to Spanish rule, but had not provided them with adequate coastal defense forces. The Iranun responded to those changed circumstances opportunistically, launching annual slave raids against the Spanish north that rarely met with significant armed resistance. The power and prestige of the Cotabato Sultanates intensified during the periods when the Zamboanga garrison was abandoned, 1599 to 1635, 1663 to 1718, and subsided when the blockade was reestablished. In the first part of the 17th century, the China trade flourished in Cotabato, and the political and economic might of the downriver polity, the Maguindanao Sultanate, reached its peak under Sultan Kudarat. By 1775, however, Forrest was able to describe economic conditions in the Maguindanao Sultanate as follows, quote, "Spaniards have long hindered Chinese junks bound from Amoy to Maguindanao to pass Zamboanga. This is the cause of so little trade at Maguindanao, no vessels sailing from Indostan thither, and the little trade is confined to a few country Chinese and a few Suluans, or Tausugs, who come hither to buy rice and palay, bring with them Chinese articles, for the crop of rice at Sulu can never be depended on," unquote. By 1800, the Maguindanao Sultanate had begun an inexorable economic decline that coincided with the expansion of another Muslim polity of the south. The Sulu Sultanate encompassed the islands of the Sulu Archipelago, which forms the boundary between the Sulu Sea and the Celebes Sea. Its favorable location at the juncture of several trade routes ensured its continuation as a maritime entrepot. The Maguindanao Sultanate, no longer able to obtain trade goods directly, was now reduced to providing rice to the expanding Sulu Sultanate in exchange for Chinese goods, formerly obtained directly at much more advantageous rates of exchange. On the basis of evidence from Forrest and others, Warren suggests that after 1780, Iranun raiders, who formerly had sailed as economic allies of Maguindanao Datus, began to raid independently or shift their allegiance to the Sulu Sultanate. Spanish economic and military pressure also impinged on relations between the upriver and coastal sultanates of the Cotabato Basin. The two rival power centers alternately aligned with the Spaniards against one another as their fortunes waxed and waned. In 1605 and 1635, the Spaniards signed treaties with the reigning upriver Buayan Sultan, recognizing him as the paramount ruler of Mindanao. In 1645 and 1719, similar agreements were made acknowledging the paramountcy of the Sultan of Maguindanao. In 1734, the successor of the Maguindanao throne was crowned Sultan by the Spaniards, and by 1837, the downriver Sultanate was a virtual protectorate of the Spanish colonial domain, with the government in Manila controlling trade and choosing the successor to the Sultan. The Buayan Sultanate, on the other hand, was increasing its influence during this period and annexing tributaries who had abandoned the Maguindanao Sultan. With the introduction by the Spaniards of steam-powered gunboats in 1846 to patrol the Basilan Straits, Iranun raids against the northern Philippines from Ilana Bay were, for the first time, effectively curtailed. This was the final blow to the economic viability of the Maguindanao Sultanate. In 1861, the Spanish flag was raised without resistance over the palace of the Sultan of Maguindanao, and the downstream sultanate became a colonial possession of Spain. The occupation of the Maguindanao Sultanate was accomplished without bloodshed, and plans were soon underway to force the submission of the upstream polity. The suppression of Iranun slave raiding in the Spanish Philippines coincided with an increased demand for slaves in the Sulu Sultanate to meet the labor needs associated with its recent position as a powerful commercial link in the European trade with China. In the late 18th century, the British East India Company was looking for a way to redress its adverse trade balance with China. In particular, it sought a means to stem the flow of silver from British India to China in exchange for the tea so highly desired in Britain. British merchants discovered the long-established Sino-Sulu trade, wherein marine and forest products were exchanged for Chinese goods and interposed themselves to the commercial benefit of both the company and the Sulu Sultanate. The British provided textiles, guns, and other manufactured goods in exchange for the marine and forest products valued in China. The greatly expanded demand for these products led to the rapid growth of the Sulu Sultanate and an increased need for the recruitment of a large labor force to do the work of procurement of trade produce. This need had been met by the seasonal slave raiding conducted by the Iranun and other seagoing raiders. With slave raiding in the Spanish Philippines greatly diminished after 1846, the gap in the supply to Sulu was filled through increased raids by Cotabato Muslims on upland groups in eastern Mindanao. The Cotabato Chinese became active intermediaries in the expanded slave trade from Mindanao to Sulu. During the 1872 smallpox epidemic and famine in Cotabato, Jesuit missionaries bought for redemption children from Chinese middlemen who had purchased them from their Muslim owners or parents with the intention of reselling them in Sulu. An 1890 Jesuit report describes Chinese traders on the upper Pulangi purchasing slaves from slave raiders. Cotabato Chinese merchants were also involved in the gutta percha boom of the 1880s. They exported this forest product, used as insulation in the building of transatlantic cable, to Singapore via Sulu. These late 19th century export opportunities gave impetus to Chinese enterprise in Cotabato, and by the turn of the century, the external trade of Cotabato as well as Sulu was controlled by Chinese merchants. His need for firearms to resist the Spaniards, along with his recognition of the shortage of marketable slaves for Sulu, provided Dato Utu, the last independent sultan of Buayan, with an irresistible incentive. He and his datus ignored the centuries-old clientage arrangement between the Maguindanaon and the Tiruray and began to raid them to acquire slaves to exchange for firearms. Hundreds of Tiruray were enslaved and taken to Sarangani Bay at the southern tip of Mindanao to be sold along with rice, cacao, coffee, and forest products to Chinese, Bornean, and European traders in return for the supplies needed to resist the Spaniards who were pushing upriver. Responding to new political exigencies and new economic opportunities, upriver datus in the final decades of pre-colonial Cotabato sold their Tiruray clients into slavery in the distant Sulu Sultanate. A combination of Spanish military pressure and British-impelled economic incentives had produced a dramatic, if predictable, alteration of production relations between Maguindanaon datus and the Tiruray, whereby collectors of commodities became themselves commodities as datus reduced former clients to chattel slaves. Spanish aggression and the myth of a unified Moro resistance. Having traced the contours of Spanish aggression against the Cotabato Sultanates and the various local responses made to that aggression, we may now turn to examine the modern myth of Morohood that undergirds the official ideology of Philippine Muslim nationalism. The myth, in its most fundamental rendering, refers to the conviction that a transcendent Philippine Muslim or Moro identity was fashioned among the various Muslim peoples of the southern Philippines in the course of more than 300 years of Spanish offensives against the Muslim polities of Mindanao and Sulu. It is a view advanced not only by Muslim nationalists or nationalist-oriented historians, for example, Mahul, 1973, but also by various other scholars of the Muslim Philippines, for example, George, 1980, Gawing, 1979, Molloy, 1988, and Bauzon, 1991. A representative capsule expression of the myth of Morohood is found in a recent piece concerned with contemporary politics of Muslim separatism in the Philippines. Quote, "For over 400 years, the Moros perceived their struggle as a fight to protect their religion, cultural identity, and homeland against foreign invaders. They have fought many wars for political independence against the Spanish, the Americans, and lastly, the Christian Filipino governments in Manila. With their strong sense of Islamic nationalism, the majority of the Muslims regard themselves simply as Moros and not Filipinos at all. Over the centuries, Islam has been important to the Muslim people in the Philippines, not only in forging the basis of their self-identity, but also in acting as the cement between deep ethnic divisions that exist among the many cultural linguistic groups that make up the Moro people." Maloy, 1988, unquote. As the passage demonstrates, Moro is the term used to designate the shared identity postulated for Philippine Muslims. Moro, or Moor, was the appellation applied to all the Muslim populations of Southeast Asia by the Portuguese, who seized Melaka in 1511. It was the same label used by the Spanish conquerors of the northern Philippines. With their Reconquista of Muslim Spain, a recent collective memory, the Spaniards in Manila regarded the southern sultanates and beheld Moros, familiar Muslim enemies. Moro denoted a Muslim inhabitant of the unsubjugated southern islands. It was applied categorically and pejoratively with scant attention paid to linguistic or political distinctions among various Moro societies. While, for instance, 18th century British and Dutch chroniclers most often refer to sea raiders from Cotabato as Iranun or Ilano, contemporaneous Spanish reports virtually always denominate them as Moros. The Spaniards referred to the non-Muslim inhabitants of the Philippines as Indios, a term that eventually came to designate the subjugated and Christianized populace. For Indios, the principal victims of Moro marauders, the term Moro connoted savage and treacherous pirates. A folk theater form known as the Moro Moro survived into the post-colonial period. It enacted the defeat of pillaging Muslim villains by Christian heroes, according to Mahul, 1985. Beginning in the late 1960s, Philippine Muslim nationalists attempted to appropriate the epithetic Moro and transform it into a positive symbol of collective identity. The Moro National Liberation Front was formed to direct the struggle for an independent political entity proclaimed to be the Bangsa Moro or Moro Nation. Muslim nationalist ideologues have proposed, with the support of certain historians, that the Spanish ascription Moro reflected an actual social entity, a self-conscious collectivity of Philippine Muslims engaged in a unified, Islamic-inspired anti-colonial resistance. More specifically, it is proposed that Spanish aggression against the southern sultanates generated an oppositional Islamic identity or intensified an already existing one that transcended linguistic and geographic boundaries and motivated steadfast and widespread armed opposition. The individual skirmishes, engagements, and campaigns are referenced cumulatively as the Moro Wars. These suppositions are confected from meager historical evidence. My reading of this material suggests, to the contrary, that Spanish aggression against the Muslim polities of the archipelago did not, to any significant degree, stimulate the development of an overarching ethno-religious identity self-consciously shared by members of various Muslim ethno-linguistic groups. Consider first the claim that the Moro Wars were fundamentally religious in character. This view is advanced by the foremost historian of Muslims in the Philippines, Cesar Mahul, who notes that the motivating force behind the Moro Wars was religious difference. The discourse of Spanish offensives against the Muslim South was undeniably religious in tone. Spanish attempts to reduce the southern sultanates into submission were voiced through an ideology of aggressive Christianization. Official documents, beginning with those from the earliest Spanish expeditions against the sultanates in 1578, and continuing up to those associated with the military campaigns of the last decades of the 19th century, order or advocate the destruction of mosques, the suppression of Islamic teaching, and the coercive conversion of Muslims to Christianity. See, for example, Blair and Robertson, De La Torre quoted in Salibi, and others. Nevertheless, this religious rhetoric is most often inlaid in texts that also announce more mercenary objectives related to monopolizing trade, controlling resources, and collecting tribute. Related to the first claim is the supposition that Spanish hostility provoked the development of a transcendent and oppositional Islamic consciousness among the Muslim peoples of the archipelago. While it is reasonable to assume that Islamic appeals were occasionally employed to mobilize opposition to Spanish aggression in the southern sultanates, there is little historical evidence to suggest that indigenous resistance to the Spanish threat led to a heightened Islamic identity among the Muslim populace, or that such elevated consciousness stiffened the resistance of the Muslims. When considering the frequency and importance of Islamic appeals, it may be noted that the two most famous anti-Spanish appeals on record, the 1603 address by Datu Buisan, the father of Sultan Kudarat, to the later chiefs, and Sultan Kudarat's 1639 exhortation to the Iranun Datus, contain no reference to Islam nor any mention of religion whatsoever. Those speeches were reported by the Spanish Jesuits who witnessed them, and one presumes those diarists to have scrupulously recorded any religious references they may have heard. The evidence available for later in the Spanish period is fragmentary and inconclusive. While there exist several accounts of religious observance by the high nobility of various sultanates, descriptions of the level of religiosity of Muslim subordinates are quite scarce. As we saw for Cotabato in Chapter 3, one of the most complete of those accounts, that of William Dampier, 1906, remarks upon the lack of apparent religious devotion observed among ordinary Maguindanaons. Prior to the late 19th century, see for example Arcilla, 1990, Blumentritt, 1893, and Ileto, 1971, there is also no direct evidence for Islamic clerics preaching anti-Spanish resistance to the general populace. Finally, there is the assertion that this postulated Islamic consciousness motivated a sustained and broad-based armed resistance. Available evidence suggests that if Philippine Muslims shared a self-regarding Islamic identity in opposition to the Spaniards, it was hardly ever manifested in concerted action against them. The term Moro Wars has been employed to describe an assortment of armed collisions occurring over more than 300 years between Muslim polities in the southern archipelago and Spanish colonial forces. It has also been used to refer to the great number of slave raids made by various Muslim seafaring marauders, most notably the Iranun of the Cotabato coast, against Spanish-held territories in the north. While often closely connected economically with one or more sultanates, the Iranun and other raiders usually had no formal political ties to any large sultanate. They were, in European parlance, freebooters, those engaged in plundering without the authority of national warfare. If we exempt the private Muslim raids against the north, which occurred almost yearly between 1768 and 1846, the 300-year conflict was primarily a Cold War, consisting of extended periods of mostly peaceful coexistence with the Spanish colonial intruders in the north, coinciding with inter-sultanate rivalry in the south. That relative calm was only occasionally punctuated by armed confrontations between the Spaniards and particular sultanates, clashes that tended to be isolated events of relatively brief duration. We need look no further than Cotabato for illustration. For the first few years following the initial abandonment of the Zamboanga garrison by the Spaniards in 1599, the two Cotabato sultanates jointly sponsored annual slave raiding forays against Spanish-held territories in the Visayas as far north as southern Luzon. Those raids were state-sponsored military expeditions, some with as many as 3,000 warriors, and were always led by the highest office holders of the sultanates, according to De La Costa, 1961. The discontinuation of major state raiding expeditions after 1605 was due in part to the growth of inter-sultanate rivalry in Cotabato, motivating the Buayan Sultan to enter into a peace treaty with Spain that year. And a consequence of the expansion of the China trade during periods when the Zamboanga fort was not garrisoned, the lucrative trade made the rulers of the sultanates both less interested in leading raids themselves and more concerned with controlling piracy in general. The 1719 agreement between Spain and the Maguindanao Sultanate occurred as a result of a plea by the downriver sultan to the Spaniards to aid him in his war with the Sultan of Sulu. The same sultan later requested Spanish assistance in suppressing an internal rebellion. Despite occasional armed clashes, Cotabato trade with the Spaniards increased steadily over the centuries. The Spaniards attempted to block the direct China-Cotabato trade, not only to force the subjugation of the sultanates, but to interpose themselves in the trade network. As a result, for the greatest portion of the Spanish period, the Spanish colonial capital of Manila was a major trading partner of the Cotabato sultanates. The largest portion of the beeswax collected in Cotabato was shipped by local Chinese intermediaries to Manila in exchange for Chinese goods, according to La Arhoven, 1989. Cotabato's history of Sultanate-Spanish relations indicates that depictions of the Philippine Muslim response to Spanish intrusions as a 300-year-long religious struggle fail utterly to capture the complexities and contradictions of that period. Muslim nationalist ideologues are not, of course, interested in unearthing discrepancies or discontinuities. As with all nationalist discourses, their narratives entail the subjugation of a threateningly unruly history. In support of their ideological stance, that a self-conscious oppositional identity as Philippine Muslims is ancient, deep, and broadly shared. I shall return in a later chapter to the official discourse of Muslim nationalism. My principal purpose in taking up the myth of Morohood here is to draw attention to its uncritical acceptance by certain scholars of the Muslim Philippines and to the theoretical and methodological consequences of their endorsements. The analytical significance of political myths in general lies less in the details of their formulation and dissemination than in how they are received and what they obscure. It is interesting to note in this regard that the myth of Morohood has been professed as historical fact by various scholars who are not avowedly Muslim nationalists. See especially Gawing, George, Molloy, and Bauzon. Their receptivity to this myth suggests that these scholars, for reasons of their own, elect to believe, despite the ample evidence of disconfirming evidence, in the ancient existence of a distinctive Moro culture, in a consolidated Moro history. Their retellings of the myth of Morohood obscure for their readers the historical complexity and cultural diversity I have outlined here. More important for our purposes, these historical narratives share the core premise that a deeply rooted cultural homogeneity among Philippine Muslims has not only surmounted geographical and linguistic barriers, but bridged social distance as well. Leaders and followers, aristocrats and commoners, are bound to one another by enduring Islamic bonds forged in the flames of jihad against infidel invaders. The presumption in these writings of a particular shared structure of historical experience precludes notice in a manner similar to those culturological depictions of the pre-colonial history of other Southeast Asian polities, of divergent interpretations of relations of power by political subordinates. It also obviates any need for the social analysis of present-day political mobilization for Muslim separatism. Ordinary adherents of Philippine Muslim nationalism are simply reenacting the pre-colonial past, driven by similar impulses and commanded by comparable leaders. It is the reason that most accounts of Muslim nationalism in the Philippines neglect the questions that compose the core basis of this study. What were ordinary Muslims fighting for? What precipitated their involvement in the separatist rebellion? How did they respond to the appeals of movement leaders? What did they hope to obtain from their participation? One other matter has been obscured by the myth of Morohood, a topic that requires our attention before we turn to examine popular participation in the Muslim nationalist movement in Cotabato. Morohood, the self-conscious ethno-religious identity as a Philippine Muslim, is evidenced among many Muslim citizens of the Philippines today and plainly predates the contemporary struggle for Muslim separatism. If not the consequence of a coordinated Moro resistance against Spanish aggression, what is its source? When and under what circumstances did it develop? I will argue in Chapter 5 that Moro identity was first developed and nurtured during the American colonial period with the active encouragement of representatives of the colonial state.